Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
So I'm Monica. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Zephyr, for asking me to speak. Very grateful to be here. I've never been to this meeting, but I've definitely heard about it and heard speakers from this meeting. So I only have 10 minutes, so I'll make it short and sweet. My sobriety date is July 1st, 2007. I have a little bit over 3.5 years. I got sober when I was 15. I'm 19 now, so I've never had a legal drink. So what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in a really alcoholic household. I'm Indian, if you can't see. There are no normies in my family. We don't even know what normal is. Alcoholic is normal. Alcoholism is normal. Like, that's what, like, those are the principles we learned, is how to be alcoholic. Like, you lie, you cheat, you steal, you keep secrets, and you don't air your dirty laundry. And my parents were arranged marriage. They met each other within a week and got married. It obviously didn't last. And so my parents got divorced when I was really young. I don't even remember them being together. And, you know, we were immediately the black sheep of the family. Like, Indian people do not get divorced. Like, I have many uncles and aunts that, like, that aren't divorced, and they have separate rooms in their houses. Like, you just do not get divorced. And, you know, that's what my parents did. And so our family forever, like, thought it was, like, my sister and I, you know, were the broken home children. They forever had to, you know, compensate for us and, like, pick up the broken pieces. And so we were, like, the charity kids. And my father, after the divorce, went into his disease and drugs, and he quickly became a meth addict and a drug dealer, and I never saw him. And my mom and my sister and I were constantly moving around, and she was constantly having boyfriends in and out, and, like, I was forever trying to fill the void of having a dad because I never had one, and it was just really sick, and I just had resentment, and I was just really, really, really uncomfortable. And my mom finally got remarried, and I got a dad, and he was awesome and amazing, and he was there, and we had a perfect little family. And I was living in San Francisco at the time, and then we moved up to Petaluma, which is, like, Sonoma County, and we moved onto, like, a 50-foot yacht, which, like, isn't enough room for 4 people at all. And you know, so, like, space was invaded. Like, we were all in each other's face all the time. Like, we had really strict bedtimes because my stepdad had to get up early to go to work, and so, like, we all had to go to bed at 7:30, like, regardless. And, like, you know, like this was how big our shower was. Like you stood and, like, you turned around and, like, showered. That was it, you know. And, like, it was a really hard life, and winters were really cold, and I got sick a lot, and, like, just really, like, depressed. But I did have a good family. Like, my mom was there, my stepdad was there, we were supported, we got anything and everything we wanted, you know. We just lived on a boat. And you know, my mom has always been that woman that gets into another relationship before she gets out of one. And I really, really, really love my stepdad to this day. He'll always be one of my dads. And, you know, she decided to cheat on him and do that for a year while we were living with him. And, like, this is, like, after they've been together for, like, 6 years now, and this is the 7th year. And it was a huge secret that I had to keep from someone that stepped into my life and, like, became a role model to me. And it just ate me alive. And that's when I started using. I'd taken my first drink. Well, I'd always been drinking whatever, like, you know, brandy tea. Like, when I'm sick, my mom was immediately, like, hot tea with brandy and chug it, like, 3 or 4 of them. So, like, we'd get drunk and go to bed. Like, she wanted us to go to sleep if we were sick. So, like, her cure was, like, get the kids drunk. And but, like, the first time I decided to get drunk on my own was I was 11, and I went to a family reunion with my stepdad's family. So it was, like, a bunch of blonde hair, blue-eyed white people, and then, like, my mom, my sister, and I. And obviously, like, uncomfort just because of that situation. And I was, like, stealing Mike's Hard Lemonades, and, like, I was stealing them for one of my step-cousins, and then I was like, dude, what's the big deal? Like, I want to try some, you know? And they were good, and I didn't taste the alcohol. I'm like, sure. And then I blacked out. And I woke up the next morning, and I got through a social situation without having to be present, and it was awesome. And, like, I was so excited for life. And so, you know, I didn't really like, my dad wasn't really around, and I knew I was his daughter, and I knew I would follow in his footsteps if I like, went on this path. So, like, I just really tried my hardest to not do anything, you know? Like, I knew it was great. I knew it was a solution, but I just, like, just tried my hardest not to do it. And, like, when my mom just, like, made me keep the secret, I just, like, went in, and I was gone. And by this time, my dad was getting sober, and so I'd, like, go and, like, get wasted and like be still up at 5 a.m. in the morning. And he's like calling me on his way to the 6 a.m. meeting at the Marina Dock in San Francisco, like telling me to turn my will to God and like asking me to say the serenity prayer with him. And I'm just like, click, like you were never there. Like I hate you and I don't want you in my life. And so my dad would make my sister and I come to his house on the weekends just to spend time with him. And what we did was go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings for quality time with daddy. And so... and he would pay us, so $20 a meeting, because I wouldn't go to a meeting otherwise, and I needed money to use with, so, I mean, it was like a win-win. Like, I took money to go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings to go get drunk, and it wasn't hard for me to get alcohol. My mom supported it. She bought it for me, like, regardless. It didn't matter. Basically, I went to high school. I had an older sister. I knew where the party was, had a social life, had the friends. I didn't have to try very hard to be cool, and, I didn't, and then I burned every bridge, and then it, like, I just took off, and I became, like, freshman year of high school, we left the stepdad, and we moved a block away from school, so I figured out that I could be a daily drinker, and no one would notice. So I'd wake up in the morning, take a couple shots of vodka, run to school, run back at break, take a couple more shots, run to school, and at lunch, I'd grab my friends, and we'd come back to my house, get drunk, and then go to, like, PE or whatever class we had at the end of the day. And so I became a daily drinker really quickly because I just, like, couldn't sit in my own skin. Like, I couldn't sit with the lies and the secrets I had to keep and, like, the uncomfortableness and, like the pity me and, like, there's no God and the world owes me everything because I've had this lifestyle and, like, my dad was never there and, like, now he's trying to get sober and trying to be there and it's not good enough. And, like, mind you, quality time with my dad when he was using was going on drug deals. So, like, I just, like, that's what I thought was what was still going to happen when I, you know, hung out with him or whatever. But, you know, just resentment. And, you know, daily drinker right off the bat. Like, I just loved it. I couldn't sit in my own skin. And when I was, I just wanted to die. Like, when I didn't have anything in my system, I wanted to kill myself. Obviously, I couldn't do it because I was too scared. But I'd write suicide notes and sit on my bathroom floor, curled up in fetal position, crying for hours, like, hugging my bottle, and, like, it was just really sick, and, I ended up burning every bridge. Like, I would go into a group of friends and, like, corrupt them all, and then they'd hate me, and then I'd go to another group, corrupt them, and they'd hate me, and I kept moving around, and I'm, like, my high school was huge, it was, like, 2,000 people, so I got to do that for a good, like, year and a half, you know, and I literally burned every bridge, and, like, then by the end of the year and a half, nobody wanted to be around me, nobody, like, I was a girl down the hallways that everybody was, like, you could hear them snickering behind my back, like, about me, you know, like, I was that girl, and then I'd hide in classrooms, whatever, and just drink, and I tried other drugs and stuff like that, but I just, mainly, I was thirsty. I'm alone. I hate myself. I want to die. We all know this feeling. And I don't know another solution. And all I know is to drink or to die. And so I hit bottom at the end of my sophomore year in high school. And, like, this thing happens. And my mom's an alcoholic as well. And she still drinks. And she has this thing. And in Indian, it's called jid. And, like, this pride and ego. We all know that. Pride and ego. And, like, she always, like, said, if you don't like it, you can leave. And so I decided to run away. But her pride and ego needed to have me back in the house. And I knew she was drunk. And so called the cops on her. She got a DUI. And because she came after me. And, like, you know. So, you know, now my mom hates me because I got her, like, $15,000 in debt. Because she decided to fight the DUI instead of just, like, taking her consequences. And so, you know, I got taken home in a cop car. I'm, like, cussing out the cop. Like, let me stay at my friend's house. And he's like, you're a minor. And whatever. And he's like, just because of that, we're going to quick release your mom. She's not going to stay overnight because I hope she kills you. And I'm just like, oh shit. Like, and my mom's scary. Like, she's only 5 foot and, like, she's Indian, but she is, like, scary. She's got these, like, big muscular arms. Like, she'll kill you. Like, I was terrified. And, so I get home and, I decide to go to bed and, I wake up to, like, hands around my neck, like, her choking me to death. And, like, her boyfriend pulls me off of me and, you know, things are good. And, like, she said you had to... I was okay. And, like, I locked her out of the room, and I'm like, oh, I'm okay. Like, I'm still alive. And then she calls my dad, and my dad, the next morning, comes and picks me up. And, like, in the morning, I get up really early, pack all my shit up in, like, four big black plastic bags, and I'm, like, sitting outside the house waiting for my dad for, like, 3-4 hours. And he comes and gets me, and he throws the plastic bags in his truck, and he's like, let's go to the city. And I was like, okay. And he's like, how do you feel right now? I was like, I want to die. I want to kill myself. Like, can you take me out of my misery? Because, like, I don't know how I'm supposed to live anymore. And he asked me to say the serenity prayer with him and took me out to breakfast and started going to meetings with him. And I started going to meetings because I wanted to go to meetings. And I put together, like, 10 days. And I would sit in, like, the way back of the room and, like, meet all of you guys and, like, sit there and laugh at you and, like, I'll be here when I'm 40. Like, I just had a rough spot and, like, just talk shit. And put together 10 days, didn't raise my hand as a newcomer, didn't get a sponsor. I didn't want a sponsor. I didn't want to do anything at 15. And then I decided to go back and hang out with, like, the one friend I had left. And I was sitting there telling them, in a, like, we're sitting in the living room, and I was like, guys, I found the solution. Like, I'm not, like, so, I don't want to kill myself anymore. Like, I'm so excited to be sober, blah, blah, blah. And they take out the bottle, and I had a huge counting issue. Like, I would count everything in the room, like, everywhere, anywhere I'd count. So I counted the seconds I could last in front of a bottle, and it was 13. And again, I blacked out. Again, I didn't know what happened the night before. Again, what had happened the night before was not something I'd want to remember, you know? And I was always a blackout drinker, so I didn't remember much at all. So I came back. And I raised my hand as a newcomer, and I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps. And real quickly, what it's like today, like, I worked the steps, and I worked them in spite, and, like, in result, I had a spiritual awakening, and I wanted to stay. And, like, sobriety is not great all the time, every day. Like, I'm 19. I totaled cars in sobriety. I've been homeless in sobriety. I, like, all of it so far, and, like, probably more consequences and more scariness, more to come. But, you know, like, the good things is, like, I have real friends here, like, a lot of you in this room, you know, like, I know people, and people know me for me, and, like, I get to be comfortable in my own skin. Like, I don't want to crawl out every second, you know, and, like, I'm happy with myself, and I get to be Monica, and, like, that's good enough, you know, like, no matter, you know, everybody doesn't have to like me or love me or whatever, or they can hate me, but I know that I'm good enough for me, you know, and, like, that's a huge, huge gift. And, like, today I'm sponsoring girls, you know, not a lot of young women want to do the steps, you know, and it's really difficult. It's like, I have to not judge a lot of my sponsees, you know, like, I didn't want to do them either, you know, when I first got here, but I'm definitely, definitely grateful to be here. And thank you for listening. Now I'd like to turn the meeting over to tonight's speaker, Jerry.
Oh. Wow. That's some share to follow. Monica, that was a great story. And, you know, well, my name is Jerry. And I want to thank Zephyr for asking me to speak tonight to share my experience, strength, and hope. I consider it a privilege anytime I have an opportunity to participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am very grateful to be here because were it not for Alcoholics Anonymous, you would certainly be having another speaker tonight. You know, Monica was 15, I was 44 when I got sober. Every possible bottom that a person can hit, I personally explored at length. My sponsor said, when you're asked to speak at a meeting, always say yes, which I did. And then he said to put on a shirt and tie, which I did. He said, come early, which I did. And then he said, tell the truth, which is going to be problematic. So I'm batting like 80%, you know, I got like 4 out of 5 going. So I am an alcoholic. I do have a sobriety date. My sobriety date is May 1st, 1990. And I've been fortunate to be able to stay sober without a drink or a drug for a little more than 20 years. I was 44 years. Thank you, Charles. I was 44 years old when I got here, so, you know, I'm well past middle age. I'm what they call a young old. I'm the young part of old. Which is kind of funny because, you know, when you get to Alcoholics Anonymous, at least for me, one of the reasons people say, hey, you know what, you don't look 64. Well, I think part of the reason for that is, you know, I was so irresponsible for so long, I never aged. Plus opiates. I took a lot of opiates. You know, they keep your face kind of flat. So, and I never had any responsibilities, so I never worried about anything. As a result, I have no worry lines. So let's assume I was about 17, which is the age I started using when I got here. So even though I'm 64 chronologically, I'm kind of in my mid-30s, which is kind of the way I feel. Like I should be starting a career of some type. And in fact, I'm at the point that most of my friends are retiring, and I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up. But unfortunately, I'm up. So whatever it is I'm doing, that's what I do. And principally what I do is this. The most important thing I do in my life is that I'm an active participant in Alcoholics Anonymous. I met a woman in AA. We had a wonderful son when I was 50, 14 years ago. He's a beautiful boy. His name is Max. He'll be 15 in May. And that has been a gift beyond my wildest dreams, because I never expected to have any of that. I never married in sobriety. I never had a home in sobriety. I mean, when I was using... I never was able to keep a job for more than a year, even though I had a bachelor's degree in political science. I have a master's degree in political science. I have at times been able to secure very high-powered jobs. This is a speaker meeting, and I'm just one speaker. So I don't feel compelled to speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, which I don't. I only speak for myself. So I want to say that now in advance. I want to welcome the newcomers. I want to welcome anyone in their first 90 days. And as far as I'm concerned, you're very welcome here. But I want to tell you something. The meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous are not the program. There's actual work to do here. And my experience has been the people that do the work do well. The people who are not willing to do the work don't do well. You know, this isn't rocket science. Okay? The question is, how important is it to you? You know, if somehow what we have to offer is not as good as what you had before you walked in, then we have nothing to offer. I mean, we're only valuable if what you find here is better than what you had outside. And when I hear people tell me, or men that I try to sponsor, you know, I think I may be able to drink again. But my position is, well, then drink tonight. Why am I wasting my time and you're wasting your time? If you want to drink, go drink. Actually, the book even says that. It says, if you think you can do social drinking, we encourage you to go down to the nearest bar and try some controlled drinking. I mean, I personally came here with nothing left in my life, nothing. I grew up in New York City. I had a wonderful family. There were no alcoholics in my family. I grew up in a Jewish family in New York with a mother and father, a grandfather who was a rabbi who lived in our house. He was a wonderful guy. My parents were great. I have an older brother who does not have my disease. He's a teacher at Columbia University in New York. As a matter of fact, he apparently, I don't know this, he's told me this since, he smoked pot once in his life and ended up in the emergency room. So I can tell you for a fact that isn't what happened to me. The first time I smoked pot, I loved it, and I made it my business that I was going to use some kind of drug for the rest of my life, every day I could. And by and large, with a few lapses, from the time I was 17 to the time I was 44, I used every day as much as I could. My drug of choice is whatever you happen to have. Okay? You know, I went through a lot of different iterations. You know, I was a junkie. I was a pillhead. I was a speed freak. Quaaludes, had a long, loving affair with Quaaludes. I got put on all kinds of psychiatric medicine. My parents, you know, in a Jewish family, to be an addict or an alcoholic is not a very acceptable fate. To have mental illness is quite acceptable. So I was routinely sent to psychiatrists and put on zines. You know, all the zines. I have a very big experience with anything ending in zine. Stelazine, Compazine, Thorazine, all the zines I've had a long history with. So I grew up in New York. My grandfather in that setting dictated the education that we would have, and I went to a Jewish parochial school. It's called the yeshiva. You don't need to know much about the yeshiva, except it's very much like Catholic school. If you never knew anybody went to Catholic school, except instead of nuns and brothers whacking you around, there are rabbis whacking you around. It's the same concept. It's very rigorous. It's very rough. Corporal punishment is definitely allowed and supported by the teachers, the parents, everybody. And I hated it. I hated it. It was a long and terrible day. School was from 9 to 6, Monday through Thursday. Friday was a half a day in anticipation of the Jewish Sabbath. Saturday was no school. Sunday was 9 to 6. And I hated to be there. I was living on the Lower East Side, long before it was the East Village in New York City. And I wanted to run around with my buddies, the Italian guys, the Puerto Rican guys, and just be a guy on the street. I mean, that's what I wanted to do, but I couldn't. I was in this school. It was for very observant Jews. I wasn't a very observant Jew. My parents weren't very observant. My grandfather was observant. And I guess the idea would be that if I got inculcated sufficiently, I would become a better Jew than my parents. I guess that was the plan. That was not going to happen. First of all, and this is something very important to my story. I believe, and I have been taught in the tradition that I got sober in and the way I was trained, that alcoholism, as we treat it here in Alcoholics Anonymous, has very little to do with the actual consumption of alcohol. Okay? If you drink a lot of alcohol, that's called alcohol abuse. You drink a lot of alcohol. But I don't see a book. There's the book. That book, that orange, yellow, and blue. If you see yourself when they describe people in that book, then you're probably an alcoholic of our type. And if you're an alcoholic of our type, we have the solution to that problem. But the essential elements of my alcohol existed within me long before I took my first drink. I know that because when I did take my first drink, it had a magic effect on me. Magic. It almost instantaneously changed virtually everything about my life that I found impossible to deal with, and as Monica said, the inability to live in my own skin. And I'll tell you what those things were. So I'm in yeshiva. It's the fourth grade, and I am what's commonly called a troublemaker. Okay? A troublemaker means I sit on the window seat and I shoot paper clips out the window and I'm trying to take out somebody's eye. I'm thinking about that. You know, and I'm a good kid. I mean, essentially, I'm kind of a good kid. I'm a Jewish kid at a parochial school, but I'm definitely looking to take someone's eye out with one of these paper clips. And it was a neighborhood that was changing from a Jewish neighborhood to a Puerto Rican neighborhood, and so they were really looking to make the people in the neighborhood feel like, you know, we take care of our own, we discipline our own, we're not going to let anyone abuse people in the neighborhood. So I line up this guy, he's walking down the street, and I shoot the paperclip, and I hit him. It's near the eye. You know, he touches his eye, and he looks up, I duck down, and he runs into the building. And he runs, and you know, within like 3 seconds, the principal is up in the room with this guy. He scans the row of the window seats, and like it didn't take a brilliant guy to realize I was the guy, right? So he comes over to me. The guy is over here. He comes over and gives me a shot. He knocks me out of the seat about 30 feet. I don't mean like a punch, you know. He just barehanded slapped me. And he really took me for a ride. My head was ringing. And then they did what they always did. He took my ear and he twisted it like this. And he took me down to the principal's office. Now, this is all going on in Yiddish, mind you, which isn't Hebrew. It's a whole other language. So we go down to the principal's office. He calls my grandfather, who's responsible for me. My grandfather comes in, and the principal said, look, the kid has got to go. The kid is incorrigible. The kid can't be trained. He can't be taught. He is too much trouble for us. He's going to kill somebody, and we don't want to be responsible. So my grandfather says to him, look, he's 10 years old. Look how small he is. Look how big you are. If you hit him hard enough, he will do what you want. So I see this not as a problem of his behavior. I see this as a problem of your unwillingness to hit him hard enough. So I saw that was not a good equation right away. If now this guy's been given permission to really, you know, take me in half. But it didn't matter because I wasn't going to change. The principal, regardless of what my grandfather said, they weren't going to stand for that. And they threw me out in what turned out to be the sixth grade. And then I started my career in the public schools in New York City. But let's go back for a second to when I'm in the fourth grade. I'm sitting in this class, okay? I'm sitting in this class, and now we're talking about my alcoholism. And I'm looking around the room. I remember this like it was yesterday. I'm looking around the room, and I say to myself, everybody in this room is a chump, okay? I say to myself, everything worth knowing, I know already. Okay? I don't mean I felt like I knew every significant fact. No, but every major insight that a person is supposed to have in life, I have already. Why am I being tormented this way? I should be teaching this class. So I thought I was smarter than all the other kids in the class, the rabbis, the principal, everybody, okay? Better than everybody, okay? But at the same moment, with the same kids, with the same principal, with the same rabbis, I feel like they all know something I don't know. They've all been given some kind of instructions that I missed. You know, when we're passing through that production line, and you know, and God is stamping people with the armor and the instructions it takes to make it through life, and I'm passing through the production line, and somebody said, "Yo, God," he turns around, I pass through the production line, and I don't get the instructions, I don't get the armor, I don't get nothing. I'm just kind of dropped in the universe, not knowing what to do at all. I mean, I see kids lamer, much lamer than me, during recess. They're obviously able to engage people. They're talking, they're chatting. You know, me, I'm looking to kill people, okay? Now, better than and less than, the same people at the same time. That was a characteristic of mine that when I drank, that would go away. Okay, my sponsor used to say to me, you know, one of the benefits of Alcoholics Anonymous is it'll take you from the edges of the page to the center of the page. Okay, it will do for you what alcohol used to do for you, which is to take you from the center of the edges of the page to the center of the page. When I mean from the center of the page, I mean what I think is what a regular person is. You know, I think when I was drinking and I became what I became when I drank, I started to feel on the inside the way everybody else appeared to be on the outside, normal, okay? I cannot remember ever drinking or taking drugs for that matter for the purpose of getting high in the sense of really being, you know, like, wow! It was maybe acid, but that's a different story. But really, largely, it was to kind of deal with life and deal with the issues of life. So, restless, irritable, and discontent. It says it in the book. I remember feeling restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm 10 years old. I haven't had a drink. Enormous insecurity, masquerading as grandiosity. That was this characteristic I was talking about in the fourth grade. Restless, irritable, and discontent. Enormous insecurity, masquerading as grandiosity. Prone to resentment. I was prone to resentment for a very early age. I tried to get you to love me. I wanted you to love me. I did everything I could to win you over. I used every possible trick in my package to win you over. But if I couldn't win you over, I was going to kill you and your family. And your family first. So that you know, I already had it planned. You know, I'm 10 years old, right? I mean, you know, I never owned a gun. I never owned a stick of dynamite. But in my own mind, I would become a very lethal mafia hit guy. Okay? And you're walking home. Your wife and children are there in front of the cottage. They're kind of waving, "Hi, Poppy." Poppy's coming home. And as you approach, the house explodes. They explode. The dog explodes. Everybody explodes. And then as you run to save them or do what you can, you trip a wire and then you explode. And I get the benefit of knowing not only are you dead, but your family's dead already and you had to watch them die. Okay? Now, this is not the thinking of a normal 10-year-old. Okay? And when I drank, all of those feelings of resentment, all that sense that I have to lash out would go away. So the last one is restless, irritable, discontent, hypersensitive to criticism, prone to resentment, and the inability to live comfortably in my own skin. That's why normies are normies. Because when they drink, they like it, it has an effect on them, but it doesn't have a magical effect. Now, when I got that magical effect, and that happened to me when I was 17. I had just started college. I knew I had arrived. I mean, I knew this was what was missing. I knew this was the key. This key opened up a lock that I didn't even know I had the lock. I only knew I really felt uncomfortable. I really didn't understand what it was. And then when I discovered drugs, the drugs were the missing piece, okay? And then later the alcohol and the drugs. It was the missing piece of what was missing for me. Because once I was able to drink and use, I became unbeatable. Unbeatable. I mean, I had the silver touch. You know, I told you I could land these jobs. I became, when I went to a job interview, I became like a gummy bear, okay? I could just intuitively wrap myself around whatever it was that the interviewer exactly needed the candidate to be like. And I would become the person in that room. I didn't become a good candidate for the job. I became the perfect candidate for the job. And I'll tell you why I've thought about it. You know, normal people, when they interview for a job, they have a set of beliefs. They have things that they believe in. They have principles that guide their lives. And when someone is asking you questions in an interview and asking you to give your opinion on things, what do you think of this, what do you think of that, you don't want to divulge too much because you're looking to say what you think the guy or the woman wants to hear, but it's definitely colored by what you actually believe about things. In other words, you can only bullshit so much, okay? But when you're a guy like me that believes in nothing, has no beliefs, has no values, you can instantly, in an interview, become anything you want to be because nothing is getting in the way, okay? And so I could be anything I needed to be for about 10 minutes at a time. Now, part of what was also happening during all of this, even when I used, was fear, okay? Fear was the constant in my life. Fear before I started to drink and use, and fear after I started to drink. It was a fear that I can't even put my finger on. It wasn't specifically a fear that anyone was going to find me out about my drinking. It wasn't a fear that I wasn't what I assumed, what I appeared to be. It was a fear that would overwhelm me, and it would make me feel like I'm a fraud, okay? I call it, alcoholics have what I call the myth of authenticity. You know, we present ourselves in our life, and we are trying to feel authentic and real with the people we're dealing with. But we don't really feel that way. We, at least for me, if you're an alcoholic of my type, I felt inside that I wasn't that guy. I was a lie. I was always a lie. I was a couple of people. I was the person who you saw. I was the person on the inside. That's at least two people. Then I was the person I was on the street when I was, you know, in drug neighborhoods, drug-seeking behavior. Then there was the guy I would be if I was at a bar, you know, like somebody out of a Miller Lite commercial, you know, playing bumper pool, good-looking men and women. I try to be that guy for a while. So this is what would happen. I would secure these jobs. I mean, just to give you an idea, once I finished my master's degree, I came back to New York City, and I landed a job as the special assistant to the Secretary of State in New York State. It was a big job. I had a big office. The guy said, the Secretary of State interviewed me. He said, look, you're the first of 10 people I was going to interview. I can't imagine anybody doing this job better. You got the job. I said, great. He said, you know, why don't you take care of whatever business you need to, and you'll start Monday. I said, fine. I think this was like the middle of the week, previous week. It was a political appointment. So I was, you know, an appointee of the secretary. And then I went home. Actually, I didn't even get home. I left the office. I'm going down in the elevator, and I said to myself, now, grant you, I haven't even done anything yet. I haven't even shown up for a day's work yet. I say to myself, I can't possibly do this job. I don't know how I convinced this guy that I can do this job. I think I actually said to myself, I don't know how I bullshit this guy into thinking I can do this job. I can't do it. You know, with the exact same power and strength that I was able to convince this person that I could do it, now I am self-convincing myself to self-destruct. Okay? So it's not as if I'm going to work a couple of days and see how I do. I say to myself, look, you're going to fail, right? And since you're going to fail, why beat a dead horse to death, right? You might as well start to fail right away. So I'm doing what we do. I'm doing what we do. I'm getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, driven by fear, and I'm drinking like a pint of vodka. Okay? It knocks me down until about 7. I'm waking up at 7 again. I'm drinking more vodka. I'm getting on the subway. I lived uptown. The job was downtown by City Hall. And I'm arriving downtown. And just to be sure I'm actually fully okay with enough alcohol in me, then when I get off the subway, I walk into one of these bars that they have around the political financial district. You know, well, places like the Blarney Stone. These are places that open at 6 a.m., and they're there mostly for construction guys. Okay, they open at 6 a.m., so the guys who have to be on the job site at 7, they can get a couple of quick belts under their belt before they have to be on the job site. So that's me. I'm going into this bar and I'm having him line up four additional shots, which I'm knocking down, one, two, three, four. You know, I get that, the warmth, that warmth that, that goes through from your toes to your stomach and out the sides of your arms. And this is the thing. And this was the thing that kept me in this disease for a very, very long time, much longer than I needed to be. So this would happen. The warmth would go through me, and I remember I would say to myself, I would take a breath, and I would feel all right. I'd feel all right. I'd feel like I can handle this. I feel like I can do anything. Okay? But that wasn't sufficient. It wouldn't have been sufficient to just at that moment feel like I'm all right and everything is going to be okay today. The kicker, the lock-in, was that the alcohol also said to me, not only is everything okay today, everything is going to be okay tomorrow, everything is going to be okay next week, everything is going to be okay next month. It's all good. It's all good. You're good. Everything is good. There's nothing you can't attempt that you won't be able to do. And that feeling would last until the alcohol would begin to wane. And when the alcohol would start to wane, the fear would come back. And the fear would say, you can't do this. You're not okay today. It's not going to be okay tomorrow. Now, realistically, now in sobriety, when I do things, when I work, I realize it was reasonable to be afraid. Everybody's afraid when they're starting a new job, okay? If I was a regular person, I would have started. I would have had some doubts. I would have had some successes. I would have had some failures. I would have learned from my successes. I would have learned from my failures, and I would have kept going. You know, my mistake was I kept thinking I was smarter than everybody. I mean, I kept thinking I hustled this guy into believing I could do this job. I didn't hustle anybody. This is a smart guy. This is an important guy in politics. He knew, he believed I could do this job because he was right. I probably could have done the job. But what I didn't know as an alcoholic was this feeling of who you see is not who I am. And so one of the benefits of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous is my sponsor has helped me by going through the steps, by working the steps in my life, by changing things about myself. This is the work that I was talking about. You know, one of the reasons I haven't had a drink today, a little more than 20 years, is not that I woke up this morning, wanted to take a drink, and didn't drink. The reason I didn't take a drink today, the reason I didn't think of taking a drink today, is the guy you see in front of you is a guy that doesn't drink. The guy doesn't drink. The reason I don't drink is I have no reason to drink. I have no need to drink. It doesn't attract me. And more importantly, the things that I've accomplished would disappear overnight. I'm locked in too much. I have a wife, I have a son, I have a sponsor, I have sponsees. I have too much to lose. It doesn't make sense. But the bottom line reason that I haven't had a drink today is because I have learned to have integrity in my life. Okay, now, in the rooms, you hear the word integrity, and most people think integrity has to do with being honest, right? Honesty, I have integrity. No. Well, it's that too. But my sponsor said, you know what integrity means? Steel has integrity. Okay? Wherever you touch a piece of steel, it's the same. Okay? You don't touch a piece of steel over here and it's this way, and you touch it over here and it's this way, and you touch it over here and this way. It's all the same. Okay? That's why I have integrity. No matter who I am, no matter who I'm with, I'm always the same. Okay? If we're having a conversation about something, and just like Monica, I don't need everybody to like me. I don't need everybody to believe like I believe. Even in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are a lot of people who think that the things I believe, the way I operate, is not the way Alcoholics Anonymous is supposed to be run. The way I sponsor men is the way I was sponsored. If men approach me and they've heard me speak, it's something like this, or they say, I'd like you to sponsor me, I say to them, yes, of course, I'd be happy to sponsor you, but I need to tell you some things about how I work with men. Nothing I tell you is a suggestion, right? I'm not giving you suggestions. I'm giving you directives. I expect you to do exactly what you're told. Now, if that's going to be a problem, I'm probably the wrong guy. Okay? Now, for men that have typically gotten to a point where they cannot stand what their life is like, and they feel like all of their own decisions have been largely mistakes, the idea of being told what to do sounds very attractive, as it was with me. I was dying to have somebody tell me what to do because everything I did wrong. You know, I was 43 years old. I was living in a crack hotel on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I'm renting my bed to crack whores, and they're paying me in rocks, okay? And, I mean, that's my life. That's my life. I'm on public assistance. Even though I have a master's degree, I can't work. I hadn't worked in a period of time. I'm not unemployed. I'm unemployable, okay? No one in my family will have anything to do with me. I've stolen from everybody, okay? My brother... I end up in detox. I'm also on methadone. I'm on all this other junk. My brother comes to me in detox. He says, look, I found a hospital in the Midwest. They're willing to help somebody like you, and I'm willing to help you go, but you cannot go back to that rat hole of an apartment you have. You have to go here from the hospital to the airport. We have a ticket, and you go. You go now. He said, but I want to make something clear. I'm not sending you because I love you, because I do not love you. He said, you were instrumental in the death of our father. Now, my dad had liver disease. He had congestive heart failure. And we all knew that in my family. He says, it wasn't what he was dying from. It's that you stuck the knife in him and twisted it because it served your own purposes. Okay? And I'll tell you what he meant. My dad was not doing that well. He also had some early dementia. But my mom didn't want him to walk around the street with no money, so she would put $4 or $5 in his pocket so that when he went outside, he'd have some money. Whenever I was invited home, and by the way, the people we burn the most are the people closest to us, because at the end, they're the only people that'll even have us in their house. Okay? So my mother would bring me to the house because she, you know, Jewish mother, she still felt she could help me in some way, make me dinner, make me some soup, make me a sandwich, something. As soon as I got into the house, I would start to look for her purse, which she had hid hours before that, okay? Because she knew I was there for the money. But my dad was in his pajamas. I would immediately go to his pants and take out the $4 and put it in my pocket. When I could find my mother's wallet, and my mother was already in her mid-70s at the time, let's say she had 3 20s or 4 20s, I didn't take all the 20s. You know why? I remember thinking about this. I took all the money, she'd know I took all the money, okay? But if I take 3 20s, then I make her doubt how much she actually had in her wallet. Now that is despicable, okay? That is despicable behavior, and that's the kind of thing I routinely did. Routinely. You know, my mom worked at a department store called B. Altman's in New York. B. Altman & Company was a very classy department store, and I lived on the Upper West Side. She lived on 35th Street. And I would be out of money, completely out of money. I'd sneak onto the subway. I'd go downtown. And I would waylay my mom as she's walking from 35th and Madison, where she lived, to 35th and 5th, where the store was. It's only one block. But I would waylay her, looking like a piece of crap. And my mother's all dressed up to the nines. She was a very classy lady. And I would accost her, like grab her throat, but I would come up to her and I'd say, Mom, I need money. And she would give me like $10 or something just to get me away, okay? Later, when I got sober, she was telling a story about how she was walking down 35th Street and she saw a bum, walking down the street. And she said, she crossed the street because she didn't want to have to deal with the bum as she was walking down the block. And as she went further down the block, she realized I was the bum. Okay? And that's what alcohol did to me. You know, when I speak, I've spoken a few times, and once my sponsor was in the room, and I spoke, and I described myself as a low-bottom drunk. This is an Irish guy from the Bronx, and he went through Harvard on a shot put fellowship, so you can imagine he's a big boy. And his skin would turn like that color red, you know, and he was at the back of the line, and his face was beet red, And he was the last one. In the meetings we went to, every single person would be online to thank you. If it was 200 people, 200 people would thank you. Obviously, you can't have a chat with 200 people. So one of the commitments at the meeting was called a line mover or longer. The line mover or longer, his job was to have you say thank you and then move along. So he's the last one. The last one, he gets to the end. He says to me, don't ever, ever describe yourself as a low-bottom drunk. Okay, you were not a low-bottom drunk. You were a bum. Okay? Low-bottom drunks were above you. All right? You, Jerry, you were a gutter greeter. Okay? When people hit the gutter, you were there to greet them and said, hi, I'm Jerry. Welcome to the gutter. Okay? That's who you were. You were a guy that lived in the gutter. You were a bum. And if you forget that, if you somehow begin to characterize yourself with some kind of highfalutin language that's supposed to make you feel better than you were, you're destined to become a bum again. And you know what? I never described myself as a low-bottom drunk again. I was a bum. I was a derelict. I was a guy. Were it not for public assistance, I would have been living on the street. Fortunately, at the time, I was on welfare. There was a category. That category has long since disappeared, so I promise you, I would have been a bum on the street. So my sponsor took me in. I only have a little bit of time. I met him in Minnesota. I went to a treatment center there. It was really more like a hospital. I went through the hospital. I ended up living. I never did return to New York to live again. I've been back many times. My brother and I are now wonderfully close friends. But 2 years, he was skeptical. He wouldn't take my phone calls for 2 years. You know, for me, 2 years sober was like a lifetime. For him, 2 years sober was a drop in the bucket. You know, I was 44. He was almost 50. This had been going on for him for 30-odd years. 2 years sober didn't mean nothing to my brother. You know, he had to see that this was serious business. And my sponsor, as I said, he was from the Bronx. He took me in. He started to tell me what to do. And he said, look, you know the way people say, don't drink, go to meetings, read the big book. He would say, don't drink, ask God for help, change yourself, work with others. Okay. So we came from a tradition where you took commitments at meetings. You had to take commitments at meetings because when you take a commitment at a meeting, it's your meeting. It's my meeting. It's not your meeting. If I come to a meeting on Saturday night and I don't have a commitment here, this isn't my meeting. This is your meeting that I happen to hit. You ever hear people say, yeah, I had a meeting Saturday night, like punched it in the face, you know? When I have a commitment in a meeting, it's my meeting. And if I have the coffee commitment and I get there and anyone has touched my coffee pot, I'm going to slit their throat, okay? So no one touches my coffee pot, you know, because my sobriety rests on making the coffee, all right? So, you know, I don't think I actually said to people, I'll slit your throat, but I said, look, this is my commitment. Don't touch my coffee pot again, okay? Because it's really not right. You know, if I don't make the coffee, I could drink. What's your excuse? Okay? So commitments. We had to have commitments. We were taught to sponsor men very early on, okay? You didn't even have to be through the 12 steps to sponsor guys. I'll tell you why. In the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, when there were no meetings, men with 3 weeks sobriety were sponsoring men with 3 days sobriety. And men with 3 months sobriety were sponsoring men with 3 weeks sobriety. You know why? You only have to stay one jump ahead of your sponsee. Okay? You obviously can't give them a step you haven't done, but there's no reason not to give away everything you have. So if you're getting down on your knees in the morning and you're surrendering to God and you're saying the third step prayer, you're telling me you can't give that away to somebody who's here desperate? If you practice the second step, you know that there's a higher power out there. You want him to, you recognize that you were insane. You ask him to bring you back to sanity. You tell him you can't give that away to somebody who's just walked in. Turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him. You tell him you can't give that away as soon as you have it. And I would tell my guys, if something comes up and you don't know how to handle it, ask me. You know, I'll tell you what to tell your guy. That's what my sponsor said. Something comes up, you don't know what to do, ask me. If I don't know what to do, I'll ask Clancy. Clancy was his sponsor, is his sponsor. So why? Why do we want to sponsor people early on? Because we want to have people feel that they are part of something. They are in what we call the center of the pack, okay? The center. If you're on the edges, you can be picked off. It is possible to pick people off. The disease hasn't given up, I assure you. The disease fully expects it's going to get you back at one day. It's only waiting to find the right moment. Okay, my sponsor always said, your alcoholism is better looking than you, it's smarter than you, it has better clothes than you do, it hits on better looking women, it gets better women. So don't think it's gone anywhere, it hasn't. Okay, it's only, as a matter of fact, it stays quiet as long as it thinks you're not in a position to hear what it has to say. Should you at some point feel like you're not doing well, you're weak, you're this and that, it will come around and it'll say, you know what, I got you by the throat. I want to thank you guys for having me. You seem to have a wonderful meeting, a lot of good energy, and I appreciate having been here.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.